You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. And a very good Monday morning to you, Mike McNamara, in for a Monday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Hope you're having a good morning so far. And thanks for taking time out to join us today. Happy Easter to everybody out there. Hope you had a very nice Easter weekend, and that the Easter Bunny was very good to you and yours. All right. So let me tell you what we're going to do today. Today we are going to take a look at North Korea again. And, you know, we just did a piece with Grant Newsham late last week. So I want to play that again in light of everything that happened. So if you missed it, North Korea celebrated the 105th anniversary of Kim Jong-un, I think is his name, his grandfather. And had a big parade, showed off new weapon systems. And I've got a diagram that I'm going to put on show notes here on the website. And I want you to take a look at it. It shows ballistic missile ranges. So it's a good little schematic that kind of shows you how far they can hit. So I'll throw that up here in a second. And so I want you to listen to that. Well, you're going to hear Grant Newsham again this morning. I want to replay the interview because it's a good one. And, you know, he lays the conflict out pretty well, I think. And, so you'll hear that, and then we'll see if we can get him on this week to talk about the implications of what happened over the weekend. So what happens over the weekend is they do their big party, right? And they're going to have a ballistic missile launch. Except the ballistic missile launch is done on the east coast of Korea near a submarine base, and the thing explodes after it launches. Now, the New York Times wrote a story. It was updated in March. It might have first been published in January. And so the story says the United States has had this cyber campaign to infiltrate the missile program, and through cyber warfare, jack up that whole system. And so the fact that these things are detonating on launch at such a high rate, a missile that functions at about an 80-something percent rate of success in Russia functions with about 20% of success in North Korea. So it's numbers like that. It's substantial. So certainly very embarrassing as the North Koreans rolled out all their stuff. So we'll focus on that a little bit this morning. The next thing we'll talk about real quick is reportedly Russia and China are both sending ships to the Korean Peninsula. Or the Sea of Japan. So we'll see where that gets us. The nation that finds themselves really the focus of the world is, will China help? Will China finally help in denuclearizing North Korea? Or are they just going to stand there with their hands in their pockets again? So the Vice President of the United States in North Korea over the weekend, and there's a plethora of quotes attributed to Mike Pence. A plethora. Okay? No more failed policy on North Korea, according to Pence. He went to the DMZ, took a look at that. Vice President says, visits the DMZ, quote, it's time to abandon, quote, strategic patience. North Korea is able to range the United States by accounts of experts given the missiles that they now own. Okay, they can transport a nuclear warhead that far. Now, how often they can do it? Good question. Can they put a nuclear weapon on top of it? Good question. So, anyway, we'll talk about those things this week. Anyway, but the vice president in Korea over the weekend, and so it goes. Another interesting story is, you know, for whatever reason, just caught my eye this morning in the early bird, and I think it's not an early bird, it's the Associated Press. Former Afghan president, U.S. massive U.S. bomb was an atrocity. Okay, Karzai, whose water is he carrying? Okay, is he carrying the Taliban's water? Why would he come out in public and say this is an immense atrocity against the Afghan people? The blast reportedly killed 95 militants. You know, so whose water is Karzai carrying when he does this? The Taliban's water? And why? So anyway, I thought that was a bit interesting. And so it goes on a Monday morning. And then Marine Corps Heritage Hour. Sadly, it's my duty to inform you all that Crossroads is going to be placed on hold indefinitely as Matt Morgan begins his campaign for election in the 1st District in the state of Michigan. So I want to wish Matt all the best of luck. He's a good buddy, and he's looking to do more leadership stuff in his life. And how can you quarrel with that? As much as we've all enjoyed Crossroads, so want to thank him for doing it. Want to wish him all the best. And again, Matt has been the. He's steered me to a number of people that have come on the program, but probably most significant is his wife Angie, who consults with businesses on leadership and hiring veterans and things like that. Angie Morgan is a great addition to All Marine Radio because of her experience, her passion for what she does. And all of that. So I want to wish Matt Morgan all the best of luck. Justin Constantine is traveling, so he can't be with us this morning. But again, there's no shortage of topics when you look, you know, around the world and what's going on the planet. So it's easy. And first and foremost among those are the situations both in Europe, the situation in North Korea, Turkey's on the news again. The referendum to essentially make Erdogan a very, very powerful leader, transitioning, it appears to be, by all indications, from a democracy to a one-man show. And again, eerily reminiscent of what Germany did in the 30s. All that power in one person's hands. It lost in all three major cities in Korea, in the three largest cities. It lost. So there's international observers that are urging that the election be put aside because they're wondering how the rest of the nation could have trumped. And the international observers for the election were not very impressed with how it was done. So, power grab for those of his detractors. And one other story in the news, and it's somewhat combat related because he fought. Prince Harry talks about his mental health issues, seeking counseling after his mother was killed. So. We have that going on. United States, in a series of steps that they've taken, has sent F-35 fighters to Europe. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. H.R. McMaster is in Afghanistan for a series of meetings on the way ahead in Afghanistan. And again, I think what you're seeing is professionals get in charge, and with the look of bringing these, you know, questions to a head. So you're going to hear our interview that we did with Graham Newsham here in a few minutes. And then after that, you're going to hear on the Marine Corps Heritage Hour, you're going to hear one of my favorite interviews that I've done is with PFC Cal Humphrey, who fought on Iwo Jima. I love it. And for those of you who haven't listened to it, you'll love it too. So sit back, relax, enjoy the morning with us for the next 3 hours. The gunner will join us, and it'll be a good morning. Anyway, so happy Easter to everybody as we get going here on the second half of April, heading towards May in the year 2017. Good morning. Nice way to start a Monday, Ryan. Come on. How do you not start your day like that and this?
Can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
All right, time for us to check weather on the Marine Corps. This. I don't have it, so I got to look it up. Current weather. In Seoul. Might as well, right? Currently, 69 degrees under mostly cloudy skies in Quantico. Sunny in 72 at Camp Lejeune. 68 and cloudy in Granbury, Texas. 30 and cloudy up in North Dakota. In 29 Palms, 64, some clouds. Camp Pendleton, some clouds at 49. Camp Smith, dark, cloudy, and 71. Okinawa, cloudy, dark, and 76. You don't see that often. Okinawa, warmer than Hawaii. But you do today. Sunny and 83 in Fallujah, at the home of All Marine Radio. Costa Mesa, Newport Beach area of Southern California, 55 degrees under cloudy skies. Looking for a high of 73 today. And in Seoul, South Korea, partly cloudy and 51 degrees. It's midnight then. Looking for a high of about 67 degrees today in Seoul. So, that's a look at your weather. When we come back, you'll hear from Grant Newsham in an interview we taped last week. So, don't go away. It's a great interview. Mac Talk. All Marine Radio on a Monday. This hour of All Marine Radio brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the one and only Battle Mug. Home security device. Yeah, that's what it doubles out as, but it's actually a mug you can drink out of. Each one starts as 10 pounds of aluminum, and they mill a machine and anodize it. Put a serial number, then it's ready for you to make your own. You can have the bottom engraved for somebody, and then it has with the Picatinny rails on the side, just like the rails on your rifle or pistol. Anything that goes on that rifle or pistol goes on your mug. And if you don't want to put scopes and lights on it, you can put emblems, flags, and things like that. Mine has the American flag and the Marine Corps emblem. Very cool. I love it. And it looks bad. Trust me. And as I say, if you punch somebody with it, they and their orbital bone are going down. So check the whole line of products out. And they've got a bunch of them. They've got the Battle Mug. They've got other products. And we'll probably have them come on and talk about their other products. You can check the full line out at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company made entirely in the United States. All right, with all that said, Grant Newsham coming up next here on a Monday on All Marine Radio, right here on the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
That's a little Skype call, and now joining me is Grant Newsham. So, Grant, first of all, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. I can't hear you very well.
How about that?
Okay, that's good.
The music was killing it. So, first of all, Grant, good morning. How are you? We're just so you know, we're on the air right now. So, So early morning in Hawaii. How's the weather in Hawaii?
I think it's good. It's outside. Yeah, it'll be good today.
All right. First of all, Grant, our listeners have met you before, but for those people who don't know you, you've spent much of your career in Japan. You know the language and the customs, and so. When things happen in the Pacific, we normally turn to you for some kind of assistance, lots of times explaining things. So tell everybody what you do, though, professionally these days.
What I am is sort of a defense commentator, mostly on Asian defense matters, really from Korea over to India. I'm associated with an outfit in Tokyo called the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. So I'm sort of like a combination George Will and Al Sharpton and Bill O'Reilly of Asian defense.
You better hope you're not. Good God, that's an awful combination.
Okay, I get carried away sometimes.
All right. Well, let's. I want to kind of go through the basics and then talk about things beyond the basics. So. For people that might be listening to this subject for the first time, can you explain the dynamic in the Pacific right now? Explain North Korea, if you can. Explain their relationship and the dynamic between South Korea, Japan, and China. So give us a general overview or the general situation, if you will.
Okay, well, I'll give it a shot. Right. Well, North Korea, I think most people probably have some idea that it's out there, but is just a horrific communist dictatorship run by the Kim family. It has many of the earmarks of an organized crime group. Actually, it's hard to describe just how, say, horrific it is in the way it abuses its people, and it just has an absolute reign of terror going, and this has been going on for decades. In the more recent era, from about 25 years ago, the North Korean regime, led by, once again, the Kim family, now it's Kim Jong-un, but back then it was Kim Il-sung, has been trying to get nuclear weapons. And it has also at the same time been trying to develop missiles. And putting it simply, it wants missiles that can go anywhere in the world, intercontinental missiles. It wants to miniaturize the nuclear weapons so it can put those on the missiles. And that gives it an ace in the hole. Once it sees it has missiles, good missiles, nuclear weapons, then it reckons it's safe. And it's been on this steady move to get it, to get this technology. The Iranians have helped, the Chinese have helped, the Syrians have helped, and vice versa. And it now has nuclear weapons, it has missiles that the technology gets better and better. And this was just an engineering problem now before it gets intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear weapons on top that can go wherever they want and hit whatever they want. And so what's been going on is led by the United States, particularly the United States, but with Japan, South Korea joining in, in particular, they have been trying to come up with some combination of persuasion and pressure over the last 25 years that will keep North Korea from getting these weapons. They failed, ultimately, and U.S. Secretary of State basically said as much just a few weeks ago. Now, North Korea, to put it in simple terms, doesn't like the United States. It constantly refers to it as its main enemy, etc. So you've got this very dangerous country that now has, if it's just talk, that's one thing, but now it's got getting the weapons to actually do what it says it will, or at least have offer the threat of attacking America or of attacking South Korea, attacking Japan. And that leads into their relationship with the Republic of Korea, South Korea. North Korea and South Korea are really still at war. They don't shoot much. Every now and then there's a shoot-up that the North Koreans do. South Korea has been pretty well behaved. But the two countries, as I said, are at war. The United States has troops and aircraft in South Korea. But within the South Korean population, you will find that there is a substantial chunk of it, particularly in the younger generations, but not exclusively, that actually sees the United States as kind of the problem. And the idea is if America would ease up or even leave, that the South Koreans and the North Koreans could reunify, because they do see themselves as ultimately the same people. So the dynamic in South Korea is a little bit complicated when it comes to North Korea, but ultimately they do see North Korea as a, by and large, as an enemy, and do keep in mind that the capital city of Seoul in South Korea is well within artillery and missile range of North Korean artillery and missiles just north of the border. It's only about 30 miles away. Now, throw Japan into the mix, and there's no, even the South Koreans have sort of rough feelings towards Japan because Japan colonized the Korean Peninsula in the early, throughout the first half of the 20th century. So there is this, it's very difficult relationship. There's mostly coming from the Korean side. Now the Japanese are far more willing to let bygones be bygones. But there has been some limited cooperation militarily between the Japanese and the South Korean militaries. Very limited, though. But it's there is some connection, and they don't. The militaries actually get along pretty well, but politically, Japan brings out the worst in the South Koreans, and the North Koreans hate the Japanese even more. So it's, and in all this, the United States is trying to get the South Koreans and the Japanese militaries to cooperate more, and also to create some political cooperation between the U.S., Japan, and South Korea. And then you have China here, and China has, sort of in the way you would try to entice a dog with a dog bone, has been sort of hinting that it can actually get North Korea to behave and maybe even give up its nuclear weapons and missile programs. And they've been promising this for many years, and they've never delivered. And finally, on the U.S. side, there's some skepticism as to how much China really wants to rein in North Korea. And as we've talked about on other shows, underpinning all of this is China's effort to dominate really Asia, both militarily, economically, and politically. So there's sort of some competing movements and forces sort of struggling with each other in Northeast Asia today. So that's sort of a short version of it.
Okay. So that is the general situation. Talk to us about the most recent developments. Most of the time, a carrier battle group operating off the, you know, in the vicinity of the Korean Peninsula is simply done. It's a matter of course. They support exercises. I won't even say freedom of navigation because that's really not much of an issue up there. But this seems to be different. Talk to us about the American response right now And then I'd also be curious, how is the Pacific Rim reacting to the visit over the weekend of the man who runs China with the man who runs the United States? So if you could address those, the carrier battle group and then the last weekend's visit.
Okay, the carrier battle group, obviously there's only so much that an aircraft carrier or even two aircraft carriers can do. But it can do something. But the real significance, as I see it, is really psychological, which is ultimately political. And that is to demonstrate that the United States, and particularly with this new administration, has run out of patience. What has happened for the last 25 years is America's really just been strung along. And except for really on one or two occasions, it's been quite willing to be strung along with this elusive prospect of negotiating their way out of trouble on the Korean Peninsula. And as I said, it's just there's a sense that everything has been tried. Diplomacy has been tried, negotiations. They've tried economic aid to North Korea. They've tried some very limited sanctions, actually. They've tried to get the Chinese to help. Nothing else has helped. Nothing has worked. And thus, the military option is at least on the table. And that's really what's being announced here with the aircraft carrier Carl Vinson going up there to the region. So it's best to think of it as a sign that the United States is now is considering all options and not just negotiations. Will it actually do anything? That's anyone's guess. One would note North Korea is a big country, and one aircraft carrier, two aircraft carriers can only do so much. But think of it as a psychological, political move as much as anything. Regarding President Xi's visit to meet Mr. Trump in Florida, the best way, I think, to look at this in terms of an Asian perspective is that most of Asia, except perhaps Cambodia and maybe Laos, does not want to be dominated by China. And they are very anxious, nervous, that Mr. Trump was going to actually cut a deal with President Xi and somehow give the Chinese freer reign in Asia in exchange for some sort of concession. So one knows that Mr. Trump did not do this at all. And you would characterize most Asian countries as sort of looking on nervously and not being willing to say much for fear that somehow the Americans and the Chinese do cut a deal, and then they would be faced with dealing with China on their own. There isn't a single Asian country which on its own could handle the growing might and power and influence of China. So they're watching nervously, and I think they liked what they saw, but it's really just one event. Once you go down the list of countries from Korea to Taiwan, even to the Philippines, despite its current leader,
right,
down to Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, everybody is watching nervously and hopefully that the Americans will finally stand up and for once say no to China, but also improve and increase U.S. military presence and activity in the region, which once again, in many respects, have a huge psychological importance to them in demonstrating that there is some alternative to this inevitable inevitably being crushed by an expanding China.
Okay, I want to talk, I want to shift gears with you, and we'll kind of follow along the same thing. So that's the, for everybody listening, that's the general situation in the Pacific Rim. So there's a little bit of a refresher course, and then brought up to snuff on the dynamic of this past weekend. A shooting war between the United States, South Korea, and North Korea. this morning, Reuters is reporting that the North Korean state media on Tuesday warned of a nuclear attack on the United States at any sign of U.S. aggression as a U.S. Navy or strike group steamed towards the Western Pacific. This obviously, and I'll quote, our revolutionary strong army is keenly watching every move by enemy elements with our nuclear site focused on the U.S. invasionary bases, not only in South Korea and the Pacific Operational Theater, but also on the U.S. mainline. Also on the U.S. mainline. So certainly the rhetoric is present, as one might expect. A shooting war with the North Koreans. Let's just say it came to that. The United States said, we won't live with this. And we're going to take decisive action to eliminate this. What happens in a shooting war between the United States, South Korea, and North Korea?
It would be sort of a god-awful mess. I think there is, these days in some quarters, there is a belief that all you do is you punch grid coordinates into cruise missiles, you launch the cruise missiles, and shortly afterwards your problems are solved. That's unlikely to happen. It doesn't really happen anywhere.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we've been cured of that false. We've tried that a couple times, I think, and it doesn't work very well.
You'd be surprised how long-lived that belief is, and it's still around in a lot of quarters. But I think this would not be short, and it wouldn't be easy. And with all wars, it would be unpredictable. There would be twists and turns, and they'd be bloody and costly wherever they led. And what you would, certainly some of the immediate things that one could expect is certainly a very heavy air assault against all the targets that anyone can find in North Korea that are of value. But it's worth keeping in mind that as good as our targeteers are, they rarely catch everything.
Right.
Or spot everything, much less can hit it. One thinks back, it was 20 years ago, to Kosovo, where once a ceasefire was assigned, the Serbians drove about 90% of their armored force out of Serbia, although the United States Air Force had destroyed it several times over, it was thought. Now, the point is that you always miss something. And even in North Korea has had 60 years to build up some fairly formidable resources. Their military does have some problems. It's short of fuel in particular. The population writ large in North Korea, even the army, is malnourished owing to just constant food shortages. So it does have some problems, but in a sort of spasm of violence, paroxysm, it could cause some immediate harm to South Korea. Because you've got something like 14,000 missile tubes within easy, or artillery tubes within easy range of Seoul, the capital, that you've got missile forces which are capable of doing some damage, and you have North Korean special forces and units and suicide squads that have been training for nothing but to get loose into South Korea. And they can cause a lot of trouble. And just the North Korean military, just the size of it, it could sort of push south for a bit. It would get hammered and really have a lot of trouble before too long. But in this process, it would just be very damaging to South Korea. And particularly keep in mind that Seoul is densely populated, millions of people, and it's also a business center. It's an economic hub. It's a first world economy. So one thing we've never seen in a potential war on the North Korea, and we haven't seen this for decades, is the possibility of first world economies getting involved directly in fighting, in suffering damage. So the South Korean economy would be jolted, not to mention the South Korean society, and expect as well Japan to be hit, either with missiles, suicide squads. You could have commandos landing, coming ashore. You've probably already got some sleeper cells in place. if a North Korean submarine gets loose. But Japan is quite likely to be in the fight, and they haven't really thought that through or exactly what they will do. And once again, Japan is a very important first world economy. The Chinese economy is a first world one as well, and that is not going to react so well to a major fight, a major conflagration on the Korean Peninsula. And all of these economies are linked to the global economy. So in addition to sort of the military problem that you have, you've also got the potential for considerable economic disruption globally. And if you want to see a stock market go down a few thousand points in a minute, just wait till the first round, the first shot is fired on the Korean Peninsula. So I don't see this as being short or easy or simple. And there really is no... There is no sort of easy way to finish it, and I would suggest that if America starts something, it will need to be prepared to finish it. And I'm not sure that everyone has thought this through, other than the military. I'm not at all opposed to using military force if that is the only option in a particular case. I wish they would try. America would play out. Would think things through to the finish, and also if it would actually consider whether it has played all its cards yet, because it has not. And I'm specifically referring to the application of some real sanctions against North Korea. America has never done this.
All right. I want to talk about sanctions, and I want to talk about if there was going to be a shooting war, and let's just say this is all rhetoric. What are the other pieces that we would see prior to the beginning of a shooting war? So let me ask you those questions first, and then I want to talk about additional sanctions. Because it doesn't seem like it. It seems like North Korea has done outside of every fence that's ever been built in the world, that they simply aren't part of the world of nations. And so I'm curious about the sanctions piece. But let me ask you militarily, since we've been developing kind of that point. Does the United States need additional ground forces in Korea if there was to be a preemptive strike in order to sustain South Korea? Would we see additional forces moving into into South Korea?
I would say that normally you would, unless there is a belief, as there often seems to be, that everything can be done by air, either air-launched or missiles, cruise missiles, etc., which has never really worked well in practice, but the belief still, it won't die, and there's still plenty of proponents of that on the U.S. side, that we just hammer them really hard using our sort of our good targeting technology and our weapons. And that will draw the North Koreans to their senses, and the problem will be solved for a while. There may be that supporters for that way of thinking, but in general, it would be safe to have some more ground troops in South Korea, just to handle the potential threat from the North. What is currently in South Korea is not enough. If the North should roll the dice and see what they can do, it's just not enough. And if you're going to move U.S. forces to the peninsula or to the region, that's going to be pretty obvious, and the press is going to pick up on it. So I'm just speaking as really a
right.
sort of outside observer, but I think you'd know if anything was being moved. And I think that in the event of a really serious fight or shoot up on the peninsula, you would want to have ground troops there. You would want more naval assets there as well. It could be these are all being moved by stealth, but I'm not sure of that.
Right.
Particularly ground troops are hard to move without people finding them.
Right.
If a ship leaves a port out sort of other than on its normal schedule, then that
right.
tends to make the San Diego Union Tribune front page, etc. So I just haven't seen a sign of that.
Got it. Grant Newsham is our guest. He wise on all things in the Pacific Rim. And that's what we're talking about. How about, obviously, I think we would see an additional carrier battle group head to the region as well. I don't know which is the closest one, but that would take weeks to get there. So maybe not. Maybe you'd see aircraft get flown to Japan. Maybe you'd see additional aircraft get flown into South Korea, if not another carrier battle group. So certainly, I think relative to the United States military, you would see additional forces move to the Korean Peninsula prior to any type of offensive action or preemptive strike.
Yeah, one would think so.
And again, the premise of that, Grant, is what you described. The North Koreans have been preparing for this for an incredibly long time. And what they've done is they have so many targets that are capable of striking South Korea and inflicting incredible damage. And they've done that with the idea that we have to be able to survive a first strike and a first exchange in order for us to adequately guarantee our own defense. And they've worked very hard at that for a lot of years to be a raid like that. And so it is not going to be a simple exchange of cruise missiles and then somebody's going to say, hey, I give up your right, we'll stop. It is going to be a violent, violent event with a lot of civilians caught in the vicinity of Seoul, and Seoul right up, you know, very, very close to the DMZ. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of paint a picture in terms of why this is not a simple exchange of missiles and then somebody quits.
Yes, this is not us all sending a few cruise missiles into Yemen. Right. This is something. This is different, and we'll see how it plays out.
All right, talk to me about the idea of sanctions. I think a lot of people look at sanctions and think, God, you know, haven't we tried everything already? Isn't that the reason that we're at this point here? And what is China going to deliver on now that they haven't been able to deliver on in the past, and why should we believe them? So take that up, don't take it up as an analyst, if you will. Can you take it? Well, you can take it up as an analyst, but could you also take it up from the perspective of the South Koreans and the Japanese in terms of perspective relative to sanctions, and why should we put any faith in China?
Okay, when you look at sanctions from the Japanese and even the South Korean perspective, and by sanctions it means really cutting off the flow, say, of goods, of supplies, but particularly cutting off the flow of money into and from North Korea. The concern, and on the U.S. side as well, the concern has always been, well, if we do too much of it, the North Koreans might get mad and they might do something. And that do something is basically attack South Korea. Now it's getting to the point, not quite there yet, where it could be the doing something involves shooting missiles and with nuclear weapons on the top of them. They haven't quite got to that point, but it's just an engineering problem. And the idea is, the hope here is that, well, if we just implement a certain amount of sanctions, we'll just squeeze them just enough to shape their behavior for the better. And we can calibrate how much their behavior changes by how much we put sanctions on. And then we can also offer the possibility of relaxing those sanctions in exchange for good behavior. It's pretty much like Robert McNamara's ideas for pressuring North Vietnam, and has worked just about as well. In short, it hasn't worked very well at all.
Right.
And it's the question of how do you deal with really a really angry, tantrum-ridden child, a two-year-old, and sanctions are one tool to use, and we just have not, the United States and its partners have never implemented effective sanctions except in one case back in 2005. But otherwise, you would think, well, how could it be that a country like North Korea does not face any real serious sanctions? And it is beyond belief. There are sanctions on things, say most recently on coal exports from China, or from North Korea to China. But China has never more than half-heartedly cooperated in any sanctions against North Korea. And effectively, it's China that has kept North Korea alive economically. There's different excuses which are trotted out. As one is, well, they don't want to deal with North Korean refugees. They don't want chaos that would come from a North Korean regime collapse, etc. But it could just be that China is very happy to have a North Korea that distracts attention from the South Koreans and the Japanese and the Americans. I've really never seen any evidence that China is going to cooperate in a serious sanction regime against North Korea, even though its people have been promising it for 25 years. Successive American administrations have acted as if China really is serious about helping them with North Korea. So I would say where we've gotten to today on the Korean Peninsula has been a bipartisan achievement of several different administrations. But as I mentioned, those sanctions really have never been tried in any effective way. I'd mentioned an incident back in 2005, which really demonstrated the possibilities for serious sanctions against North Korea.
Grant Newsham, you know what? I guess I'd tell you that I'm—I don't want to say I'm jaw-droppingly surprised, but I'm a bit surprised because. If you asked me, I would tell you that I thought that we had attempted to contact sanction North Korea, and that had been tried already. Now I will tell you that I never thought that China participated in any of that, and so it would be new if China decided to participate. I'm somewhat surprised that this hasn't occurred. So give me your sense. Have you seen any indication that China has changed? The lack of a reaction, from China, they've been relatively, quiet. At least I haven't seen any major story coming out. Of China commenting on North Korea, and the only story I did see was that they've moved 150,000 troops to the Yalu River to control refugees should anything happen in Korea. I'm curious about those two pieces. Do you think that China? Have you seen any indication that China will change its tune and attempt to either lean harder on North Korea, or if in fact, as some have contested, that they don't have the influence that we think they do, they will join Japan, South Korea, the United States, and other Pacific nations and sanction in a real way North Korea?
I'm skeptical. I've never seen any indication that China has helped us with North Korea. But it is held out there as lure to really shape our behavior. I just haven't seen the evidence for that, really not one shred of evidence. That story about moving 150,000 troops to the border, it's questionable. But once again, this belief that China is going to save us and bring North Korea to heel, I've not seen any indication it's accurate. And China could. They could, with really economically squeezing North Korea, the game would be over very shortly.
Really?
So they do have that kind of leverage. The one thing to keep in mind is that sanctions have been applied and are still in place against North Korea, but they suffered from two main problems. One, they've been too narrowly focused. The Chinese have never more than half-heartedly enforced them. So there's always been a huge amount of trade which continues with North Korea despite sanctions, despite promises of the various countries to enforce them. One unbelievable example is the ongoing, steady, constant flow of luxury goods that are only for the benefit of the Kim regime and its cronies. That has been going on forever, pretty much unstopped. There's been a huge number of amount of illicit activities that the North Korean regime does overseas, drug dealing, counterfeiting, etc. to make them money, that have never been seriously cracked down on by anybody, not even the U.S. With all its resources. And then there's really the quite licit activities that you got a whiff of in Malaysia the other week, where you start got some attention, where you have North Korean, you have restaurants that North Koreans run. There's about 50,000 to 100,000 North Koreans who work overseas in really as in forced labor in Europe, the Middle East, China, Russia, and things like mining, logging, the textile industry, construction, and they don't live very well. Their money, their pay goes directly to the, or pretty directly to the North Korean government. And this would be as if the Russian gulag back in the Soviet Union days had sent, inmates overseas to earn money for the Kremlin elite. So you've got this combination of just ongoing activity that earns the regime money that keeps it alive, just as a criminal gang needs money to stay alive. And this has never been seriously cracked down on, and it's the U.S. that has to really take the lead, and they've never done it for some reason that I don't understand. And now here we are talking about war before we've actually tried a real effort with sanctions against North Korea, and like we did for a short while in 2005-2006, that were the most effective things the Americans have ever done against North Korea since the Incheon landing. So there, that's your Bill O'Reilly and Al Sharpton.
For those of you who don't know, that was part of the Korean War, and so it's been a few years. My guest, Grant Newsham, former United States Marine Corps intel officer, been serving in the Pacific. What was your, how old were you when you made your first trip to Japan, Grant?
Well, oh goodness, I was fairly old actually. I was probably like 28 or so.
Wow, that is old. I mean, to yeah. Go there. The Japanese perspective in all of this is what? Nervous anticipation. Korea, as you pointed out, an uneasy relationship between the two of them. Japan, I'm sure, would like it to be better, but the scars from the colonial experience in World War II are still remain and are still political considerations for the South Koreans. What is Japan's perspective in all of this?
They're, put it mildly, worried. I think is one way to compare it is suppose, say, that Mexico had sort of a pretty good missiles, was building nuclear weapons, and was threatening America. That's pretty close by. And Japan has always been very worried about North Korea. But the worries have just gotten worse and worse on the line as North Korean missile technology and missile abilities, my capabilities have improved, and there really is an immediacy to Japanese concerns. Once again, from missile attack, from Korean special forces getting loose in Japan, from floods of refugees headed into Japan, interruption in trade. They're very worried, but they have never really developed sort of an adequate defense for it against the North threat from the North. And as a result, they ultimately depended on the United States to help them out and to save them. Japan is trying to do more with its military now, but it hasn't. On its own, it would be would have some problems. It's done things, for example, like it's bought Patriot missiles to deal with at least part of the North Korean missile threat. They haven't perhaps bought as many of spare missiles as they might have, but that's the Japanese approach to things. But they are indeed very worried, and there's even a widespread talk in the Japanese administration, the political world, and people who think about these things, that maybe Japan needs its own, they call it, strike capability or something like that. Basically means maybe they should have their own missile forces to be able to eliminate a threat from North Korea. And this has been talked about for probably 5 or 6 years now. but it's getting more and more attention. I'm not sure that the Japanese side quite understands everything that's involved in that. And there is a belief that just having some very accurate missiles that you can target them, send them on their way, and thus solve your problem easily. That belief is still widespread, really, in Japan, Japanese government circles. There's a few people who understand what's really required, but not everybody. So Japan really is worried by all of this because and North Korea says all the time that they're going to attack Japan, make Japan pay for this or for that. So there is a lot of worry. If you went to Japan, of course, as a visitor, you wouldn't notice it. But in Japanese government circles, there is a lot of concern here. The Japanese-Korea relationship has always been stressed or strained, as we mentioned. But the Japanese would be love to be good friends with the South Koreans. But that's not sort of the Koreans don't respond quite the same way. Although the relation on a person-to-person relationship, the relationship can be very good, but in general it is strained. There's also about probably somewhere up close to about a million Korean Japanese who live in Japan. They came over mostly during the colonial era, not always by choice, but sometimes by choice. So there is actually a Korean-Japanese part of the population, which has some influence, not a whole lot, but it is an influence that one notes.
Grant Newsom, our guest. Grant is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo. And Grant, I hear that, and I'm going to read you an email. Kind of alludes to something that we spoke with earlier. I don't know if you know retired Marine Corps Brigadier General Tom Drowdy, but you may. He was on earlier in the program, and we were discussing, and I'll read the email because it alludes to it. Hey, Mac, I'm curious how the Japanese see their own defense in the Western Pacific. They have North Korea very close to them. They have China close to them. China is expanding. A bit ago, when General Drowdy was on, you talked about the atrophy of NATO and then the message that sends in terms of sustaining peace. And normally the way you do that is you do that through strength. It seems to me the Pacific alliance has atrophied as well, in that you have Japan constitutionally limited from having a large army, and then it seems like nations like Taiwan and Australia have allowed their militaries to atrophy as well. I'm curious about Grant's thoughts on this, and because it seems to me, just like in Europe with Putin marauding around and acting like a gangster, you have similar behavior in the Western Pacific, which would be easily deterred by the United States, Australia, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea standing together, and they say, hey, we will not allow that. Why doesn't this happen? Grant's thoughts on it. So the atrophy of many nations' ability or desire to defend themselves, Grant, your thoughts on it?
Sure. By the way, I've met General Drowdy a couple times. He's a good guy. He knows what he's talking about. The atrophy sort of idea, that's actually accurate. It, of course, manifests itself a bit differently from between Europe and Asia, but the basic idea, that's basically correct, that the almost all of these nations, except perhaps Australia, which is really so small, have allowed their militaries to develop in ways that don't make sense, the sort of stunted growth. They can do the wrong things, and they can't do the right things that they need to do. For example, they have huge ground forces in a lot of cases, but they can't do amphibious operation. They've got high-end aircraft, but they don't face any real threat. So there is a sort of a huge military atrophy or problem or imbalance in Asia. I'm just taking the Japanese, however, as one example. It's I think part of the, I think compared to some of our NATO allies, they actually have been very aggressive and supportive in building their defense. I would say by comparison, they do have a really good-sized military with some good hardware, but it has not really been ever been structured or even forced to be able to operate in joint operations, combining air, sea, and ground. That's a really an effective military needs to do. And I think the a main reason for this is the pathologic dependence on the United States for the last 60 years, where there was always a belief that, well, the Americans will take care of everything. We just have to do enough to be able to do a few things, but ultimately make it look to the Americans like we're doing something. That's a little cynical, but not entirely far off. And that pathologic dependence, what it means is that Japan has never felt forced to develop the capabilities and the ability to use the weapons they have in an effective way. And because you can always count on the Americans to backstop you, to the Americans to have the essential equipment that's necessary. And that pathologic dependence is never a helpful, healthy thing in any relationship, in foreign affairs or even personal relations, I would say. Plus, the Japanese have never spent enough on defense. They spend more than most NATO allies, which is, you know, to their credit, but they just don't spend enough. They've underspent by tens of billions each year for probably 50, 60 years. I would estimate that Japan probably gets $25 billion in free defense services from the United States every year. They have been for decades, and one gets used to that. But it's manifesting itself today in a Japanese defense force, which is only partially effective. Korea has had some problems, some similar problems in terms of overdependence on the United States. But, you know, the dynamic, the circumstances are a bit different with the South Koreans. And through all of this, though, the Americans have really been quite happy to just take on, to do everything if necessary. And that worked until there was a real threat in the region, which there wasn't until about 20 years ago when China started to build up. And this idea that, well, the Americans will take care of everything, it's something we were, it seemed, glad to do, that just doesn't work anymore. And then you go down the line and just go down country to country, and you will find that that every military there has some serious shortcomings, either in terms of size, sort of the modern weapons, and the ability to use them. And this is not even talking about the political willingness to use them. General Draghi were to go visit the Taiwan Marine Corps at their headquarters, he would feel as though he had walked onto a Marine Corps base in about 1959. That's how familiar it all is, and it's also just how it hasn't changed into a lighter, more maneuverable, flexible force. But that's just one example from Taiwan. But you go down, and throughout the region, the militaries have been imperfectly developed. And once again, Australia is something of an exception, but once again, it just doesn't have the size or the scale to be that effective. But it's a very useful bunch to have around in any sort of situation. And so there really has never been an Asian NATO, and one would suggest that it'd be very hard to see something like that happening. But ultimately, it's what really is essential is that the United States has got to take the lead if it wants to remain a force in Asia. It's got to take the lead bringing together these disparate militaries into some sort of loose, at least cooperative agreement. That it doesn't even have to be spoken. It just has to be understood, and every now and then do something useful. And a structure for that could easily be the United States, Japan, India, if you could bring them in, and Australia into the mix, and South Korea where it can. Vietnam could play a useful role. Taiwan, if we were to ever pay it some attention that it deserves, they could be very useful. Indonesia could play a niche role, Singapore as well. But it does take some imagination on the U.S. side to make this happen. And I'm not sure that I've seen much interest in that on the U.S. side. There is in some ways a preference just for doing exercises and going around the region, flexing our muscles and putting on a Harlem Globetrotter show. But really has not produced many concrete results in creating something of that sort of informal cooperative alliance that I just described. But that really is essential. There's a lot to work with. If we were to make the effort to do that, it would be nice to see some imaginative types of whom we have plenty being given the rein and the freedom to go, quote, figure it out.
Grant, first of all, I know it's early in Hawaii, so I want to thank you for getting up and doing this. The issue is a complex one, and you come on and you do a great job in kind of putting that mosaic together in a way that we can understand that. I've got one more email question, and then I will let you go. Mac, first of all, I love when Grant comes on. He is great relative to explaining what goes on out there. And to be honest with you, every time I see his name, I make sure I listen. You should listen anyway. What the hell? My question for him is this. What does he expect to happen next? Is this a grand game of posturing that we see? Or is there something more real that is bound to happen? I know the whole world is watching and wondering. What does Grant expect to see next?
I predict Redskins Super Bowl victories every year. So
we'll take it with a grain of salt.
I think that it's going to get worse and worse and worse in Asia. Not that it's going to be a hellish place just yet, but this is not going to resolve itself. Even if you took North Korea out of the mix, you would still have a China which is militarizing very nicely, quickly, rapidly, and its stated intention is to push the United States out of the region. So the United States either gets pushed out or it asserts its interests, and that could potentially cause some friction, will cause a lot of friction. There will be a lot of bluster and threats from China, and I hope we haven't waited too long before pushing back. So I would expect that relationship to be strained. The Chinese are going to make a move in the East China Sea at some point to teach the Japanese a lesson and also to pick off a little bit of Japanese territory. I would expect that to happen. As for the Korean Peninsula, as noted, at this point it's really just an engineering question unless before North Korea gets the missiles and nuclear weapons that will go where they want them to go, anywhere on the globe. And no matter what administration it is in the United States, they have to make the very, very difficult decision as to do you live with that or do you do something about it. I think we've probably never been closer to having an administration, but also people outside of the administration in the U.S. who are willing to do, at least contemplate doing something about it. One has always heard that, well, the possibility of war on the Korean Peninsula is just unthinkable.
Right.
North Korea wouldn't do it, and we wouldn't get involved just because it's too just unthinkable. Well, it is thinkable, and we are going to have to deal with that probably sooner rather than later. So the region is not going to become as nice and placid as Bermuda anytime soon. I think it is going to get awfully interesting, and I think it is probably going to get pretty rough in the near term.
All right. Well, Grant, again, appreciate you always getting up early for us, and I hope you don't mind as these events unfold. One of the first calls you'll get will be for me, and continue to come on and make us smart. So thank you very much.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
That is Grant Newsham. You know, it's interesting you hear interviews for a second time, and they sound different. At least to me, they do. He's an interesting guy to have on. when you don't have expertise in that region. And you know, it really makes you look at, you know, the people who have led the nation and said, where's your vision for, you know, the defense of freedom around the world? And specifically the defense of American interests around the world. And for whatever reason, you look in both directions. You look east and west, and you look at the neglect relative to our alliance, their investment in their own defense, and it's astounding. Honestly, it's astounding. Because if our alliances are strong, there's nothing, you know, the clown states can do. Iran, Russia, and China. They're nothing. Because they couldn't afford it. And they would never win. So we're going to take a quick break. This hour of Allmarine Radio brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug with its Picatinny rails. If you're an operator, you need a mug like this. It's perfect for any commemorative event, promotion, retirement, farewell, mess night, Easter, Memorial Day weekend, anything that you're looking for a special gift. Check out all their products, battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company made entirely in the U.S. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you're going to hear from Cal Marvin on a Monday edition of the Marine Corps Heritage Hour. Crossroads, Matt's going out on the campaign trail, so we're going to put that on hold. So more of this program coming up next.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website. Look at what events they have lined up. Attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
I'm good.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Seven 34 here on a Thursday morning, 9:34 in the Midwest, where my guest is from. He is none other than Cal Humphrey. Cal, first of all, thanks for taking time out of your day and joining us here on All Marine Radio.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, that's awesome. What do you, first of all, we need to learn about you, okay, so we can know if we can take you seriously. You're born and raised where?
Well, I'll tell you what, I got my discharge out so I could remember myself what the hell happened to me. born in Emporia, Kansas, 1925, and then we moved to St. Joe, Missouri. The folks moved to St. Joe, Missouri. I was just a child, and that's where I grew up pretty well. We really moved to Mound City. We did a little town north of St. Joe, but we grew up in that area.
And how many brothers and sisters?
I had two sisters and two brothers.
So five families and a kid, that's a respectable number, right?
Well, back in the 30s, that was kind of a small family.
You know what I was going to say, in the 50s, in the 60s, we had four. And I looked at my mom and dad like, well, what's wrong? Why? The Seymours have eight.
Yeah.
You know, the Demers, they have 11. Like, what the hell? Four? Are you kidding me? Are you guys?
Yeah. That's kind of like we were, you know, we were the smallest probably in the area. There was 8, 9, 10, even up to 15. And the hell of it was most of us lived in two-room houses with no light, no electricity, no water, no running water, you know.
How did that work?
Well, it worked fine. We didn't know any difference. I think I was 15 before I got into a house that had electricity and running water. That's when we moved down to St. Joe from Mound City.
Where'd you sleep? You got five.
Well, hell, you generally had two bedrooms and a kitchen, maybe a little bitty old living room.
Right.
And you always filled the bedrooms with beds, and the girls slept with. And mom and dad and us boys all slept in one bed, you know.
Fighting.
Back then, it was pretty cold. You was happy to have a couple guys with you.
How does the Marine Corps get on your radar from Missouri?
Well, you know, we were back in World War II. You know, nobody thought about not going.
Right.
Everybody, I mean, it was just a fact you were going to go to service.
All right, hold on. Let me stop you. First of all, where were you on December 7th? What were you doing?
I was in school in Lee Summit, Missouri. I was down there. I wasn't living at home. I was working for a farmer down in Lee Summit, Missouri.
How old were you?
I was 17.
17. You're working, going to school, and on that Sunday morning, did you go to church? Were you a church going kid, or what were you doing?
Well, I was a church going kid till I got big enough to sneak off and go fishing.
So you were fishing that morning?
No, I was probably milking cows.
All right, and so when you heard about it, as you just said. Nobody thought about not going. Everybody was going to go do their part. Did you know anything about the Marine Corps at that time in your life?
I didn't know anything about the Marine Corps, and we didn't pay much attention to the war. You know, we were just living. It really wasn't like these wars now where you get, you know, you all got radios and everybody had a damn thing, and you hear everything that's going on, you know.
Right.
We didn't hear hardly anything. Unless something really bad happened, there'd be a little article in the paper about it or something like that, you know. But we didn't sit around and watch television, and because most people didn't have them. You didn't have television back then.
Wow.
I got my first television. I went to come back from the service and went to farming. And I bought the first television in that farming area. It was a little bitty old thing, you know. I'd sit there and look at that just amazed how they could put that picture on that thing. But see, back then we didn't get the news like you get it now. You know, when some 15 minutes after somebody gets shot overseas, we hear about it.
Right.
We didn't have that news. We didn't have that news cycle that we got now.
Yeah, that's not a good thing either, I don't think. The my guest this morning from the great state of Nebraska is Cal Humphrey. And Cal's nephew, Jess, is a colleague of mine. I'd like to call him a friend, but I'm very careful who I call friends there.
Mm-hmm.
Cal, but he was a member of the Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 27th Marines, on the volcanic island of Iwo Jima. He's gracious enough to join us this morning, and we're talking about where he was prior to the war. So December 7th rolls around, and then how the hell did he get in the Marine Corps?
Well, I'll tell you what, they just put me in the Marine Corps.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I it says here I was 66 and a quarter inches tall, so that was a 5'7". And I probably weighed about 130. So I think the Marines were needing people.
they were needing people. Holy smokes. So 130 pounds at 5'6". Holy smokes. So they tell you you're going to be a Marine. And what'd you say? Okay.
I didn't know anything about it. Yeah, I said okay.
And so then where did they send you?
Well, they sent me to boot camp in San Diego, and I think that's about a month. And then we went to that line camp up there, Pendleton.
Right.
And we were there for a few months, and then we went to Hawaii, and we spent most of our time in Hawaii up there on the King Ranch up there in the desert, training.
Right. And now this
and
is not...
we had a lot of training.
And this is, hey, Cal, this is 1942?
It was three, wasn't it? Four, three or four.
40, okay. All right.
Yeah.
And then, and so you're in Hawaii, and now you're training with the 5th Division?
Yeah, the 5th Division, 27th Marines.
All right. And that gets made, for people that are familiar with it, what a lot of Carlson's Raiders, a lot of Paramarines made up that. That was a pretty pretty experienced group that you walk into.
Absolutely. I think that's why they put them in there, because all of them came in. I think they made them all sergeants and corporals and things like that, because all of our squad leaders were from that group, you know, that was with Carlson's Raiders.
What were they like? What were they like to train with? So you report, you're fresh off the street. You go to boot camp, and now these guys have been fighting for a while. What were they like to work with?
They were great guys. They were great guys. They had been, they'd been through the ranks. They knew everything. They weren't up there, like when you went to boot camp. You know, those guys were jerks, but these guys were really good guys, and they knew everything, and they weren't trying to show off. They taught me an awful lot, and I had several friends of them that were really good friends of mine. In fact, I had, my platoon sergeant was really a good friend of mine.
What's his name?
What's his name?
Yep.
Yes, you shouldn't ask me.
You told me Les Jenks.
Yeah, a real good friend. In fact, he stopped. He was coming. His folks were owned a mortuary in New York, and he retired. When he came, him and his wife were going to California. They stopped there and spent a couple of days with me in Omaha.
How long ago was that?
Oh God, that's been a long time ago. Probably 12 years, 13 years. 14 years. I know I've been here 29 years, so it's been a long time.
All right.
So when you get my age, I'll be 91 next month. When you get my age, names and dates and times kind of go by the wayside.
That's a long time to, have to remember. That's, a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
That's, when you're young, you don't have to remember that much stuff, but as you get older, there's a lot of stuff that you got to remember.
Well, I can still remember stuff I did when I was 4 or 5 years old, but a lot of times I have a little hard time remembering what I did yesterday.
Yeah, trust me, I'm with you. I'm with you, and I'm anyway. I think Jess told me that John Bazelon was in your battalion.
John Bazelon was in the 28th.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Did you?
I knew John. Yeah, he was in the 28th.
How did you know him?
Oh, I see him up Flop Chute. Back then, they had those slop chutes on the where you could just go up, you get beer for 15 cents or something. A lot of people went up there every night. John was there quite a bit, and I talked to him quite often.
Tell us about him.
He got nutty, he got that award,
right.
And when we went into Evo, I think he thought he was going to do the same thing. Well, hell, he got shot right off the bat.
Right. What kind of guy was he? I mean, I
thought he was a pretty nice guy. Well, of course, we was all about that snockered when we were together, but
right.
I thought he was a fine guy.
Really? So you do your training, and then what's the most memorable thing in terms of either what you learned or in training from the group of guys that comprised you know, your NCOs and the leadership of the 27th Marines? What's the number one thing they taught you?
Well, they just taught you a world of stuff, you know, that how to take care of yourself and try not to be a hero, but do your job. And they were pretty good, but the hell of it was, they didn't last very long. Most of them were killed on the 34th day on Iwo. In fact, our lieutenant was killed. The first one we had wouldn't get it. We were all about six of us in a big shell hole there, and he wouldn't get out of it when we had to leave. Had to go on across that field.
So he was a smart guy.
Yeah. And then the next one we got lasted about a day and a half. I didn't even hardly get to see him. And then we didn't get any more. We didn't have any more lieutenants all the way through when I was there.
All right. I have an email for you. And if you have a question or comment, you can send a text message to 714-661-8107. You can send an email to live.allmarineradio@gmail.com, or you can call if you want to ask Cal a question yourself. 714-884-4294. The question says this: Mac, where did 27th Marines land on the morning of D-Day? So,
well, we had the beaches were, colored like red, white, and we landed on red.
All right, red was so the closest to Suribachi was Green Beach. That's what's 28th Marines, right?
That's where they landed. We all the first wave, which I was on, landed in Amtrak. And, you know, they ran us up on the beach as far as they could go.
Right.
And then we bailed out of the damn things, and that beach was, you know, that's all volcanic ash. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but
yeah, absolutely.
It's soft and tough to walk in and run in, and we got in pretty good. We got up next to the bank, and then the Higgins boat started coming in. Of course, then the all hell broke loose. You know, that was a devastating thing there. But for the first 2 or 3 hours,
let's talk about that, Kel. So you guys were in track vehicles, and you're off the coast, and the Navy's plastering that, and the Navy and Marine Corps Air are hitting the island. What were your thoughts as you were headed to the shore?
Well, I was manning a 50-caliber machine gun on that Amtrak, and so I was standing up where I could see everything. And there wasn't any airplanes. It was all naval.
Naval guns.
Yeah, and you couldn't even see the island. And you know, it takes you a long time to get in. Those tracks don't go very fast. You know, you get out there, you all load up, and then you run around in a circle till everybody gets lined up. And the time you lined up, a division's going to hit the beach. You know, crush. You got people lined up for a mile.
Right.
And then, so we get in, and they take us up on the beach as far as they can, and then the Higgins boats start coming in. And of course, they quit shelling it.
Right.
But then the aircraft came in and started bombing it.
Okay.
The Navy aircraft, small ones.
Right.
And then all hell broke loose, you know, from the Japanese. And of course they had that island all gridded off so they were very effective. They just killed the hell out of guys. You couldn't hardly see the back. When you look back, you couldn't see anything part of the dead guys, and they had a lot of boats out in the water.
Right.
It was a really, I don't know, I think we probably lost an awful lot of people. I don't know any numbers or anything like that, but just the looking, it was terrible.
Right.
So, and our mission was to go straight across the island, across the airfield to the other side, and right. The 28th was to go and turn and go and take Suribachi.
Okay.
They took that in about 3 days, I think, because I remember seeing a little flag put up there about the second or third day, I can't remember what, this little bitty old thing. And then they had the big ceremony, you know, where they got a big flag up there and took the picture.
Matt, can you believe that after 70 years they finally identified the right people in the picture here in the last
Well, I can believe that. You know, it was a confusing situation over there, no matter what you did, you know.
Right.
So, I can believe they were all up there, and he was trying to gather up a bunch of guys to put that flag up. You know, he needed about two. What did he get, six, seven?
Six.
And to make a picture, and it turned out to be great for him.
Yeah, hell of a picture.
It sure was.
But
I can believe they could have made a mistake, because there was probably 6-18 guys standing around watching, you know.
Yeah, and they were up there for a while. Do you remember? Did you see the first flag go up? Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, no, I didn't see it go up. It wasn't very high. It was only about 3 or 4 feet high. It looked like somebody carried it up in their pack or something. You know,
right.
just a little one.
But you,
I told the guy. Remember, we were starting to go the other way, but we were still getting some fire off Sarabachi, you know, some rifle fire. And I remember we turned around and looked at that flag, and I said, well, we won't have to watch our asses anymore. It looks like they've taken that hill.
Just to answer the emailer, if you look at where 1st Battalion 27th Marines is on Red Beach, it goes from the south, adjacent to Suribachi. 28th Marines is on Green Beach. Then there's Red 1, which is 2nd Battalion and 27th Marines. Red 2 is further north, and that's where the 1st Battalion 27th Marines lands. And it's probably right at the base of airfield number 1. So there's a gap between airfield number 1 and Suribachi. That's kind of 2nd Battalion 27th Marines and then 28th Marines. 1st Battalion 27th Marines, it looks like you guys headed right across the southern end of the airfield to the far side.
And we were supposed to go clear across that airfield, the far side. And the far side, you didn't go to the water. There was a great big, looked like 20-acre depression there that was kind of sea level. You know, you go down another bank So that's as far as we went. We didn't go down in that depression there, and then we turned and went up the island.
So this is your first time in combat, Cal. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So do you remember as you got on the island, what the hell is going through your mind as you see, you know, you're involved. You don't know it yet, but you're involved in one of the greatest battles of World War II and certainly in Marine Corps history. What were your thoughts as you were,
you
were coming off the beach?
You know, you're so dumb, I guess. I really wasn't all that frightened till we got on up there and you know, then when you get into these battles and you get mortared, you know. Of course, we'd lay in those goddamn foxholes and get to shaking. Our teeth would bump, and your flesh would even twitch. You know, you'd be so goddamn scared. You'd be terrified.
Right.
But when you got out, you kind of laugh at each other and go on. But it's a terrifying thing. And some guys get scared. They just lay there like babies. They couldn't. They had their rifles so tight you couldn't hardly get them out of their hands, and their teeth would be, you know, just like they're going to pop their mouth and be so tight. But it was a terrifying thing. But the first day didn't seem to bother me too much, because I was too dumb to know what the hell was going on, I guess. But even with the guys dying, you know, we all kept toilet paper in our helmets, you know, when we go on these.
Right.
We did that back in the States when we go on, when we go out. I remember looking up there when I was on the beach and I see that toilet paper flipping down. I thought, oh my God, somebody's head blew off. But it's enough to make people go nutty in a fruitcake, you know. That first day didn't seem to, I just didn't know what the hell was going on, I guess. I suppose you're just kind of numb.
When you think about that first day, do you have a lasting memory? One thing you remember, anything more than other things on the first day?
Well, I remember we had a foxhole right up in front of us, right on top of the hill there. It was a, it was a cement dome thing,
mm-hmm.
and we had the Jinx said, we've got to take that damn thing out, or we can't get out, we can't get over. It did have some cracks in it where I guess the bombs done something to it. And he sent a couple of the older guys, crawled up there and got a flamethrower in it. So we got by that obstacle in pretty good shape, and we got back up on the airport, and it was just littered with bomb, big holes. It was, hell, some of them were 6-7 foot deep, you know, and 15-20 foot across. I don't know what kind of bombs made those, but
big bombs.
They were good for us because we could kind of hopscotch from those from one to the next and get across there. We didn't have to dig any foxholes going across that airport. We just kind of moved out, crawled around, and got over.
And you guys got to the far side, and did you get to the far side on day one?
We got there in about day two, I think it was.
Okay.
Pretty well. Day one, we didn't do too much. We had a lot of snipers. There were some snipers out on that airfield in some of those holes, and there was, I know there was a plane, looked like an old plane that had been scrapped or something. There was a sniper in. They did get a half track up there and blast it out of there. That's when we got out, our hole moved on out. And I remember they told us on the out in the ocean, they said, well, they didn't think the Japs had any guns on there to do anything bad to their tanks, you know. Well, right. Hell, the first tank that went up above us just got blown to hell. I said, well, let's settle that.
I guess that answers that.
Yeah.
Maybe they do have an anti-tank gun up there.
I think they convinced those tank guys today too, because that first one went up.
My guess this morning is Cal Humphreys. He a member of 1st Battalion 27th Marines, Alpha Company, as it were, and landed on Iwo Jima in 1945. And we're talking about the landing. I've got another email question. Mac, how did, as a young guy, his first battle, he said he wasn't that scared that day, but I'm sure that he's given the death he saw on the beach, it had to make an incredible impression on him. Did he just put it out of his mind and keep going because that's what he had to do? Cal, so, I mean, you saw stuff you'd probably never seen in your life that day. How did you deal with it in your head?
I think everybody dealt with it the same way. I think it was just awesome. You were just there, you know. You were just there. I don't think probably your mind wasn't there altogether, but you had a few things to do that kept you busy. We had to keep moving out, try to move out. Of course, and you could hear those goddamn bullets whizzing by you, and then they were still shelling the beach and shooting mortars at the beach. The thing that really saved a lot of us was those mortars went down in that pretty deep in that ash before they went off, which probably saved a hell of a lot of guys.
So if it would have been normal dirt and they would have been surface bursting mortars,
it exploded, it would have been terrible.
Right.
We might not have got on there.
Wow.
But it, I can't explain it. I guess your mind kind of does something to you. I mean, what can you do? You can't panic and run back out in the ocean, and you goddamn sure don't want to run ahead. So you just kind of stay there with everybody else, and there wasn't anybody to shoot at.
Yeah, how did that piss you off? All this stuff's going on, and there's nobody to shoot at. What the hell?
Well, that's what I say. You just don't know what the hell to do. You couldn't dig a foxhole on that crap.
So you kept you kept following Jenks.
Well, you just.
I hope Jenks.
He was like us. He didn't go very far either.
I hope Jenks knows what he's doing because I'm behind him. Now, you and I were talking the other day, and I said, "What was the secret to you were wounded on what, deep plus 19?"
I think so, something like that.
Okay, and I asked you what was the secret to that, and you said never be the first one out of the fighting position.
You need to look around a little. But we were all pretty careful, but still a hell of a lot of us got killed.
Wow. All right. Tell
there wasn't any safe place. There wasn't any safe place. When you got up there and you had to go back and replace people, you know, you can't do that hardly on the front line. So it was worse back there than it was on the front line because you had a company back there digging in, and hell, that island was, you could see pretty well everywhere. Those guys were a little on the high ground compared to when from the airports, you know.
Right.
Christ, you'd just get the poop mortared out of it. It didn't last very long, 15, 20 minutes, and then our guys would find out where they were and start throwing mortars back, you know, and get it stopped. But 10, 15 minutes, mortars flying all around you is scary.
That'll piss you off. You know how long? Now we have a radar beam that we shoot across the ground, and when they shoot something at us, it breaks the radar where it goes up, and it breaks it where it comes down, and then we get the exact grid that they shot it from. So
that has helped us to beat hell because it generally probably took our guys 10, 15 minutes to
see it, right?
Locate them.
Yeah, they had to see it.
Uh-huh.
Which means they got to see enough shots to find that thing. What the hell is it? Oh, it's over there. Well, now, you can imagine that. Let me tell you how it works now, Cal. We'll have one of those drones flying overhead,
uh-huh.
And we have this, it's called counter-battery radar, you know, laid out across an area, let's say Fallujah or Ramadi in Iraq, and then they shoot. And as soon as that thing comes back down and breaks the plane the second time, you get the point of impact, you get the point of origin, and then you very quickly take the point of origin and you send it by computer to the guy running the drone. He takes the camera, and the drone goes right to that grid, and here they are standing there.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, in less than 60 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then guess what happens at about 4 minutes into it?
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
The only thing I thought they did wrong is bomb. They used bombs. I always told Les, I said, if we can get these guys to drop napalm, we'll be in good shape. But these damn bombs they can't get anybody in any caves. They can't really hit those pillboxes. I said, unless they're lucky.
So napalm. Explain why napalm was effective.
Oh hell! They'd drop that stuff and it would. You know, it spread for a long ways, and it'd cook them. It even gets hot, you know, and go in the mouths of those caves and stuff like that. But if they'd have dropped napalm on that island, they'd have probably hurt somebody. But all that other crap, I don't think it hurt anybody worth a damn. Breached a few pillboxes, but I don't think killed very many people.
All right. Now, Cal, I've got to take about a two-minute break. Can you hold on, and we'll continue our discussion?
You betcha.
All right. From Omaha, Nebraska. Is it Calvin?
Calvin.
Calvin. That's kind of a Baptist name, isn't it?
Yep, probably.
Calvin Humphrey. He's the uncle of a good friend of mine, Jess Humphrey, and he's gracious enough to join us here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. We're going to take about a two-minute break. We'll come back. We'll continue our discussion about what it was like to fight on Iwo Jima. More of that coming up next.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Five minutes after 8 o'clock here on a Thursday morning. And privileged this morning to be joined by a veteran of the Battle of Iwo Jima. His name is Cal Humphrey. And a member of the 27th Marine Regiment, Alpha Company, which makes him part of the 1st Battalion. And we continue our discussion and kind of talked about the first day, Cal. I got a couple emails, so let me ask them. Mac, early in the battle, what killed the most Marines? Was it indirect fire, mortars? Was it machine guns? Cal?
I think it probably was mortars and shells.
Okay.
There was a lot of bullets flying around, but I don't. You hear them whistling by, you know, like kind of make a sound when they go by you. But I couldn't answer that question. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Next question.
And some parts of the beach was a lot different than others, you know.
Right. Right. No, I mean, it's very interesting as you read different accounts of the battle, how much it's, how different it is depending on where you were.
Sure.
Next question is, Mac, how did those guys sleep? It seems like when you read about the battle, they operated almost what would seem to be 24 hours a day because of the Japanese threat being all around them. How the hell did they sleep?
You had two men to a foxhole, two men. One was supposed to be awake all the time. We had to be conscious of that banzai crap, you know, they pull everywhere.
Right.
Every night. So we had the Navy shot flares. That island was never dark. It was, you know how a flare is, it kind of, you can just see. And so we'd set our grenades up. We'd set our machine guns up. We'd set our 37 millimeter guns in our line with the canister ammunition, spread out our BAR men, because we didn't know when this bandai was going to come, early in the morning or night or what the hell ever.
Right.
And that's one guy was supposed to sleep and the other guy was supposed to stay awake, which hell never happened. You know, we both went to sleep. But hopefully there's enough guys somewhere around in the line that wake up and start shooting, wake you all up. At the end of the thing, we killed a lot of Japs at night, one at a time. I don't know whether looking for ammunition or water or, you know, walking around out there. And my guys, when I was took over the squad, we killed one the last night before I got hit. I told the guy, I had two recruits with me because they were just got them that day. And I said, I want you guys to aim and I want you, don't shoot till I tell you because I want this son of a buck to get up close enough we can kill him. I don't want to wound him out if they're throwing grenades at us. So we got him done. But a lot of these guys listening to this might think that old guy's nutty and a fruitcake. You know, you keep hearing all the time these people don't want to talk about Do you ever hear that? You know, you don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, he came home and never said a word.
Well, that's what I told one of my boys. You know, he said, "Well, Dad, you never talk about it." I said, "Let me tell you something. What am I going to say to you? I come home and see your mom and say, Mom, I just spent a month without taking a bath or changing my clothes. And ate K-rations every day. And I did brush my teeth once in a while. I thought I was going to have enough water, but I had to use the same toothbrush I cleaned my rifle with.
Who the hell
wants to hear that crap?
How'd that taste?
It wasn't too bad. And then you run out of toilet paper. You got to wipe your butt with your hand and clean it off. I said, one thing we did have, we had that. Well, can of cash cleans your hands up pretty good.
Does it? Well, they use it in a lot of soaps now, right?
I said, you can't talk about that kind of stuff, and you damn sure can't talk about people getting blown up and getting their arms blown off and spitting in a foxhole with some poor bastard bleeding to death. You can't do anything for him but give him a morphine shot. And you can't, I said, this isn't the movies. You can't call a corpsman because first place, they probably couldn't hear you, and you wouldn't want to have somebody have to get up and get killed getting to you. And if he was smart, he wouldn't get up. So I said, it's just horrible. I hear these wanting to put these girls into combat. It's probably like you say. It's probably nothing like we went through. So maybe these girls can handle the front lines, but they can't handle the front lines like those boys had to in World War One. No matter where you are, were you in the Pacific, were you in the couldn't do it.
I don't think they can do it, to be honest with you, Cal. I mean, you might be able to do it back here, but you know that.
Yeah, they couldn't do it, and you wouldn't want them to do it. For Christ's sake, who wants to take our national treasures and put them on the front line?
Yeah, no, Marines will handle it. You know, just like if you had a weak guy, what do you do with him? He's going to go work in the office. He'll be the company driver. He'll do this. He'll do that. They'll find something for him because there's not that many women that'll do it. And quite frankly, In fact, we were having an interesting discussion about that the other day. It's like, so a squad leader, somebody gets confused. What's the squad leader do? He grabs them and throws them.
Yep.
Right? And he didn't have time to talk. Hey, go. And,
no.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. They just can't. I'll tell you what I carried. I had that M1, you know, was loaded. That weighs about 9 pounds.
M1 Grand, right?
I had a 20-pound explosive, and I always carried competition C2. I had 3 concussion grenades, and then I carried a phosphorus grenade because I like to throw those. And then you got probably 4 or 5 clips or 6 or 7, however scared you were, you know.
Right.
And you had had your other little crap you're supposed to have with you, you know. You had canteen, your bayonet, and your K-bar and all that crap. A woman can't do that.
Yeah, well, let me tell you.
Unless they're just tougher than hell. They got, well, I shouldn't say that. A lot of them could.
Well,
some of the guys couldn't.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. Like,
I
couldn't
carry a flamethrower. They weighed about 60 pounds. Hell, I tried it. I couldn't even get 10 steps.
With the flamethrower?
And even if I could, I'd have said I couldn't. Those things get you killed.
Listen to this. This is written by a Marine Corps Sergeant Major who was involved in the testing that the Marine Corps did with female Marines, and who all, you know, by every account, you know, did their best and are good Marines. It's just not an easy task. He says this: the best women in the Ground Combat Integration Task Force as a group in regard to infantry operations were equal to or below, in most cases, the lowest 5% of men in the group in the test study. So that was the best woman is equal to or below the lowest 5% of guys. Okay, now, so what does that tell you? That tells you that it's hard work, and, you know, the weaker guys struggle to do it, and, you know, I'd say, and that's what the test says, that the lowest 5%.
And he is right, because we had some of them, and we had some that couldn't do anything. One of the guys, there was 2 guys in my platoon, Les Yanks, the sergeant, and a kid, don't say his name, but a kid from Chicago, that I don't think he walked a step on Iwo Jima. He was damn near crawled everywhere. And he wasn't worth a damn. I don't think he probably even fired his rifle.
Wow.
And I'll tell you something else probably nobody would realize, maybe like in other areas it was different. I saw very, very few jabs. Very few.
So how did you, okay, so.
It was all digging them out, blowing them out, covering them up, sealing up the caves. And you'd see I told Les one day, I said, you know, Les, we've lost over half of our platoon, and we haven't visibly seen kill over 7 or 8 or 9 jets. You know, when we'd blow up a pillbox, we'd get them all, or some little structure they had built. But the ones in the cave, you might see 1 or 2 in the door, and then you'd throw a phosphorus grenade in there and then seal the damn thing up. But I said, we're not, if these guys are moving backwards, when we get to the end of this island, it's just going to be all people.
Right. Right. Well, let me ask you about that. I have an email that says, Mac, I'm looking at a map of the battle, and 1st Battalion, 27th Marines, goes across the island, and then they turn towards the northern end of the island.
Right.
And they run in to the eastern side of Hill 362 Alpha, which was built like a fortress.
Right.
Tell us about that thing. I've seen pictures and diagrams of that thing. They turned the mountain into a pillbox.
They turned every little structure they had into a pillbox. Every little structure. And there was, back when you got on the big end of the island, there was a lot of those, not like that hill,
right,
but like, half as big and 2/3 as big, and they all had caves in them. They all had, oh God, they had everything, every place. That guy that ran that island, that Japanese commander set that island up, he was a genius.
Kiribati.
Yeah, he was really a, he must have been a genius. He must have been the best officer they had in the whole Japanese army, because they did never do anything foolish. They never ever showed themselves. So he had them extremely well trained, I guess. I don't know, but it was kind of like fighting ghosts. You know, you knew where they were, and you knew damn well they was out there because they was killing you. But you damn sure couldn't see too many of them.
Kyle Humphrey, my guest here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. We're talking about the Battle of Iwo Jima. And Kyle, the other thing about Hill 362, which is what you're talking about, is not only was it the hill itself that was, you know, fortified, but all the terrain that surrounded it, you know, that ringed it, was shooting as you tried to close with the hill. You know, Marines were getting shot in the back, were getting shot in the side from the cliffs off to your right as you were moving to the north. And then from, you know, on the northern side, on the far side of Hill 362, the terrain, that there's a hill that goes up kind of behind it, you know, that dominated the approaches to it. So it was, you read about just getting to it, to get to it. You had to fight to do that. And it just, you know, the tactical problem that he put in front of you guys, as you said, he's a smart guy and absolutely brutal in terms of what it cost you guys in terms of casualties.
Yep. Well, when we got over to that edge of that island, you know, like I told you, we didn't go down in that big swale.
Right.
It was quite a swale there. We went right around that, and when we come to the Hill 362, see, we stayed on this side of it and went on around that curve, and that little depression was behind us.
Right.
And we were getting some shots from the rear, and I looked down there. They had a trench all the way up, a kind of a berm all the way across that thing, and it had gaps in it. And they had holes they were shooting at us from back down there and from on top. And we could walk probably had 12, 15 feet we could walk if we stayed up close to that bank. But if you got 2 foot out of that, you got shot. I had a good friend with me, Red, his name was Red Cole. And I said, now, Red, don't get up there. Don't get up there. Stay down here. Damn if he didn't walk up there, and damn if he didn't get shot. Right through the side, went in one side and out the other, and I grabbed him and pulled him back down by me, and he said, I can't feel my feet. I said, you'd probably be all right, Red. You're just hurt. But we had to leave him. They you just stick a rifle up. If they're alive, you don't put a helmet on top of it. If they're dead, you stick their rifle in the ground and put a helmet on top of it. But the litter bearers, hell, they couldn't keep up. They took mostly the live guys, and the dead guys a lot of times left and laid around for a day or two. But we finally took that. But that devastated, pretty well devastated our company. We had I don't know, they trained us, you know, to walk in single file and leave distance between us, and you know how guys are, right, right? Right. If there's a little jump, they have to jump over pretty soon. They're all bunched up in front of it. We did lose one complete full platoon just right off the bat there. And from then on out, well, we kind of was a little bit more careful how we did things, you know, one complete squad.
My guest this morning, Cal Humphrey. He a PFC when you went ashore. And when did you become a squad leader?
I became a squad leader about the last week, and only because I was one of the, there was three of us left, a guy by the name of Groneman, and me and a corporal. And we were up in those hills, and we were walking down through we had about a 20-foot canyon we had to go through, and the bottom of it was all eroded out, and they came to a little wall in front. front of it. It was about, 5.5 foot wall. Well, you know how you do when you, we had all new guys, but three of us. Damn, they didn't all crowd up in there, you know, right behind that wall. And I was bringing up the rear, and there was a cave on one side of it, and pretty soon grenades started coming over that wall, and guys started shooting out of that cave, and Jesus Christ, it was a mess, and I did finally get up there and kill a couple guys in the cave, threw a grenade in there, and threw a couple over the bench, but it was, you just didn't have anybody, the groomer got killed right off the bat. And that was, we got a lot of medals over there in that island because the officers were so close, they could see damn near all the combats, you know. They could see all these firefights.
Right.
And I got a Silver Star for that little episode, which wasn't anything but a bunch of bullshit because that kind of stuff happened every day.
It sounds like it did. Well, I got another email for you, Cal. Mac, as Cal looks at the battle, what was the most difficult part of the battle in his opinion?
Well, the I guess the worst part was, you know, when you had an objective, you just had to move out and you had to take whatever you had to take, you know. And like you say, if they had a cave, they had it protected by a couple of pillboxes, you know, out to each side, and maybe some spider holes, and maybe another little bunker or two. But they were all pretty well tied in, so you just, if you attacked one, you got shot by the others, and that was really hard and really tough. But that didn't bother me near as bad as laying in a foxhole getting mortared or a shell hole. That's what damn near run me out of my mind. In fact, I told Les one time, I said, Les, I'd just soon stay up here. I'd just soon not go back.
Oh, yeah, as they rotated your platoon and company?
Well, you had to go. Yeah, they rotated the company generally because you'd get up there and you might lose a platoon,
right,
half, and then you'd have to move another platoon up and lose some of them. Then you got to go back and get reinforcements. You can't get reinforcements up there, you know. Right. Damn, you got to go back.
Right.
It wasn't on account of ammunition or anything like that. We always had plenty of ammunition.
Just getting new
short of water once in a while, but other than that, we had plenty of ammunition. And
all right, so the mortars are the things that used to piss you
that's
off.
That's what scared me, Landon. You knew damn well somebody was going to get. They're going to hit some of you.
And all right, another question for you, Mac. Did Cal use the same rifle throughout the battle? Those guys must have pumped a lot of rounds through those rifles. Did he wind up getting a new rifle at any point because he wore his out? I've read stories about that. The same rifle the whole time, Cal?
Yeah, same rifle. And to be right truthful with you, we didn't really shoot that much. If we saw anything, or if we saw a hole, or if we saw this, or we saw that, we shot. Or, like, if we were going up to, we had to take the flamethrower guys up. You know, three of us would go up before him and crawl up, and he would come up right behind us. And then we'd try to throw a few grenades and get a spot so we could get up there and put that flame in that hole of that cave or into the, and they shoot pretty far. Those flamethrowers are shooting 35, 40 feet, I think.
And that was forever on Iwo Jima, right? I mean, when most engagements are taking, you know, place less than 20 meters.
Oh, hell, they were terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible. Yeah, when you got in close and you got the, if once in a while those Japs would run out of those pillboxes and you'd see them, you know, they knew they were going to get burned after a while.
Right.
So they'd, but they very seldom ever came out of the caves. And we could seal those caves pretty easy.
I got another email for you. Mac, did after hearing that he was wounded on D+19, that must have felt like an eternity in terms of time in close combat. Did he think he was going to get killed?
everybody thought they were going to get killed, and that's what I told the recruits when they came up to me, well, the ones I had after I took the squad over. I told them, look, guys, now, the odds of getting out of here alive are just almost nil. So anytime you see something move, or you see a hole in the ground, or you see a hole anywhere or anything, shoot at it. I don't give a goddamn, shoot your whole clip up. We've got a lot of ammunition, but shoot at it. And keep your goddamn heads down. Don't be getting up, messing around, and looking around and not paying attention. Look in all directions, but look forward. I did not wear out my rifle. No, it was, I left the damn thing.
Tell us how you got wounded.
Well, we were, B Company had got wrecked that day, and our captain said, well, we're going to have to go fill in that line. So my platoon had to go fill it in. And of course I was, Les said, you take your squad, Kelly, left and go on down. You'll probably meet up with somebody down there on the end. Well, hell, we didn't meet up with anybody. I didn't see anybody for a quarter mile down there. So I told the guys, well, as far as we can go, so we'll just stay here. I'd seen where a tank had turned around, you know, and left a pretty good depression. And I said, you guys we can dig in here a little bit and lay here in this tank track. And the next morning early, a tank came up. They must have called for it.
Okay.
And a guy popped out of the hood and he said, well, I'm looking for a target. And I said, well, you're the target, you dumb bastard. You're clear up here on the front line. I'll get on the phone and talk to you. So he got back in. I got up and walked around the back to grab that goddamn telephone. No more had it in my hand, and the mortar started falling. And it killed my two recruits. And I think I was, the one that got me was on the other side of the tank, because it just hit me in the upper body. And, of course, that tank, he back, he could tell, I, yes. He put that, I didn't know this tank could burn rubber. If I'd been behind it, he'd have squashed me dead.
So you got hit,
hit me pretty good, I couldn't hear for about a month and a half out of that one ear, but it got me all on my left side, but none in my legs or anything, so the tank had to be protecting me a little bit. And I busted a vial of smelling salts and thought, well, it's got to be a goddamn aid station around here somewhere if they had that big a battle yesterday. And I staggered back there and found one back there.
So you walked back under your own power to the...
Walked and walked and crawled and sat and rested and smelled my smelling salts.
How long do you think it took you to get to the aid station?
Oh, you know, I don't have any idea. I don't know. You know, time just doesn't seem to make any difference to you when you're hurt. And I was hurt.
Well,
I had a couple of... Those Japanese must have had a lot of powder and not very much metal, because they put a lot of powder in their mortars, and they put a lot of powder in their grenades. And it busted them up into real small pieces.
Hmm.
And I had two pieces go in my chest. They left that in there.
Still got it? Still in there?
Yeah, still in there. And I had two pieces go through my helmet and stuck between my skin and my scalp. And a piece went through my arm, and then I had a pretty good piece hit me kind of on the chest there and dug a teacup full of meat out of there.
Teacup.
And I just, you know, and I think the concussion probably was what hurt my ear.
Yeah.
And that kind of makes you a little bit nutty, so you just don't know. I went the right way, probably.
In your case, nuttier, right?
Yeah, nuttier.
So, well, Cal, look, first of all, I've got one more question for you, and then we'll let you go. But can we do this again sometime? Can I give you a call when you come back on? Because there's a lot of lessons that we have to learn from you, and we kind of heard the story for the first time. So I'd love to talk to you some more. But I've got one more question for you, and then
okay.
All right. What makes a good Marine?
Well, I think a guy that can kind of keep his common sense. You know, the first thing they want to preach to you and get in your head that you're 10 foot tall and bulletproof, and you're not. So those guys that know what they can do and what they can't do, and still keep their goddamn common sense instead of waving that flag all over hell, makes a good Marine.
So don't lose your common sense.
No.
And know that you can be just as dead as anybody else out here.
Absolutely, and everybody else in the service is just as good as you are. A lot of them came back from being on leave and the weekends and found out that those Army boys were just as tough as they were.
In spite of everything you saw in the movie?
In spite of all you see in the movie, absolutely.
Well, I'll tell you what, Cal. First of all, I can't tell you what an honor it is to have you on the program here. I've read about Iwo Jima and the battle. I think as a lot of Marines have most of my military career and stand in awe of guys like you who went over and fought that fight on a daily basis. I can't tell you what it's been, what a thrill it's been for me to have you on. And I am gonna, I don't give a shit if you tell me, yeah, don't ever call me again. I don't care if you say that. I'll call you and bug you and drag you back on this program.
Yeah, this doesn't bother me much. I'll lay awake a night or two, but then I'll get over in a hurry.
Did you have very many, mental problems when you came home? I mean, we call
it. Never had any, but I'll tell you what I did. I didn't go to any conventions.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't belong to the goddamn place where they all went up and got drunk with those. Everybody joined those.
The Legion and the VFW?
Legions, you know, American
right.
Legion.
Right.
I joined and spent on my money, and I still do, but I don't go in the joint. And I don't go. You know, I don't go talking war talk to everybody. I just forgot it and left them alone. And I just had two buddies that I visited once in a while when I went to Phoenix. They both lived there. And that was my, the limit of what I did about it. Now, I don't think I didn't dream about it a hell of a lot, but I'd get up and read a book or something. I didn't lay there and suffer. So I got along great.
So you came and came home and tried to get as far away from it as you could.
Just didn't want to be involved in any of that crap.
Interesting. All right, sir. Thank you very much today.
Okay. Well.
And we're going to do it again in the not too distant future. So.
All right, that'll be fine.
All right.
Okay. Bye bye.
All right. Bye bye. That is Cal Humphreys from Unbelievable. Right. Unbelievable story of life on Iwo Jima. And, you know, you hear his perspective. They teach you that you're 10 feet tall, but you can be just as dead as everybody else. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue a discussion we had yesterday we're headed for the Chosen Reservoir. Don Bennett's going to join us here in a minute. More of All Marine Radio. Coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio. Yeah, Iwo Jima to the Chosen. Come on, are you kidding me? Look, this is a dream come true job. I keep saying that every day, but it is. More of that coming up next.
How about that for an interview? I don't know how many times I've heard it. I could tell you that I could listen to those interviews forever. Hearing guys talking about their experience, especially with, you know, that's one of the things about that interview is, you know, here he's fighting in the first battle he's ever fought in, and just coincidentally, it is one of the great battles that the Marine Corps participates in its history. So it's a historic battle. It's and he's just given, you know, the bird's eye view of that, right? The PFC view of Iwo Jima, what that was like. So anyway, I need to thank Jess Humphrey, who is Cal's nephew, and he set that whole thing up. He said, you know, you need to have my uncle, he calls him Calvin on, And so it was obviously our privilege to have him on, but I sit here and I listen to that stuff and I just think that, I just sit here and shake my head at some of the things he says when he talks about Montana man. You know, I want to say it was out of his mouth for maybe all of 30 seconds when Montana man texted during the initial interview. He said, did he just say about a teacup full of flesh they took out of my chest? I said, yeah, that's what he said. And, so it's pretty cool stuff. You know, just, you know, in that Midwestern common sense kind of way. Very interesting. So we're going to take a quick break. Gunner a bit other than the weather today. He won't join us. So we'll check some news headlines. I'm trying to get Phil Smith to join us. But Phil is a Beirut veteran and a great guy. I worked at IOC with him. Interesting guy. Smart guy. Well thought, well written, well spoken, and fun to have on. So we're going to take a quick break on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour of All Marine Radio brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the one and only Battle Mug mug. Starts as 10-pound block of aluminum. After it's milled, machined, and anodized, it's a incredible product for you to customize. Each one has a serial number. You can have the base engraved. Mine has the blue diamond on it, my name and my rank, and when it was given to me. And the unique feature of the mug itself is the Picatinny rails. So I'm going to walk you through a few of these products here in a second, and then we'll have somebody from Battle Mug come on. They haven't come on in a while, so maybe we'll do that tomorrow or Wednesday. And we'll talk about all the different cool products, but I'll name a few off for you here in a minute. They're great gifts for any kind of commemorative event. So you can check out the full line at battlemug.com, enter the promo code Marine, and if you do that, you get 15% off. So it's a veteran-owned and operated company made entirely in the United States and a great sponsor of All Marine Radio. So with all of that said, take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio on a Monday, the 17th day of April. Don't touch that dial.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. A little cowboy music on a Monday. Is there anything better than the lyrics of country music? No.
Trying to decide which way to go. These empty miles in her memory. They just seem to linger.
One of the great things about having your own show, you could like sing when you want to.
She left me on this lost highway.
My boy Tracy Lawrence in studio. What up?
That's how a cowgirl breaks a young man.
Somebody getting their heart broken. Always happens.
So it came apart with a cold and empty stare. If I was there, she didn't even stop to cry. That's how a cowgirl says goodbye.
All right, 9:28 on a Monday here on the West Coast. We're talking, we have some nothing time. I got some emails, so let me get to the email. Hey, Mac, I heard you allude to something that you guys are doing with Turner Construction, 100 entrepreneurs. Could you make us smart on that? Yes. We're looking for combat guys and girls. Okay? If you worked in a theater, not a movie theater, but a combat theater, and did your job there. Turner's looking for people that have been leaders and have led under pressure. And if you can lead, they have career opportunities for you at Turner Construction. Now, you can look them up. Just go ahead and do a search on it. Google it. And we've had the last 2 weeks, we've had guys come on and talk about it. So, and if you want to go ahead and listen to those interviews, they're great interviews. They're great interviews. I just got an email about that, so I'll talk about that here in a second.
Last week we had Matt Parker, Sergeant United States Army, double amputee above the knee. Nielsen steered him towards Turner Construction. He's now an estimator for Turner. And he said, no, my leadership skills were what I needed. And then when I got there at Turner, there was veterans there that helped me. There was other people that mentored me. But Turner was great. Turner was great. And he said, and I had done a little carpentry work, but I didn't really have a background in construction, you know. So, no, he said that opportunity opened, and I've been with him ever since. So, I mean, just so, you know, great stories about guys going in and finding careers in those kind of situations. And then the week before, we had Pat Murray. And he's a Sergeant United States Marine Corps. And Pat is an amputee as well. And so he's working for the VFW now. And he talked about, you know, how he started working at Turner Construction. It opened up a whole series of professional opportunities for him. And he didn't really have a background in construction, but they said they were looking for leadership. So what we're looking for is we're looking for veterans with leadership experience. Turner Construction's interested in you. All right? So if you can do those things, which if you wore the name NCO, then you probably could do it. Okay? And you can send myself an email here, so mac.allmarineradio@gmail.com. So you can do that, and you can email Bob Nielsen as well. All you got to do is go to the 100 Entrepreneurs website and go to the contact, and you'll see how to email Bob. So either way, easiest way is just to email me. And let me tell you, if you know people that are looking for work, I mean, we're talking construction management, construction leadership stuff, right? So those are big time jobs. That's big stuff. You're giving somebody a career. So yeah, that's what that's about. And you know, for us, really exciting because when I started All Marine Radio, it was those kind of things. I wanted to talk about post combat related mental health. I wanted it to be a horizontal theme throughout the program. That just about everybody who comes on. I mean, even Cal Humphrey a few minutes ago talked about how he dealt with his stuff. You know, it's not like I didn't have any bad dreams or anything like that. He said, but I didn't want to relive it. So I didn't go down to the VFW and Legion. I didn't sit around and talk about it. I just wanted to get it out of, I wanted to get it out of my system. So, that's what he did. That's what he did. And so this, I mean, again, that's what he tried to do. So I everybody copes with it. Everybody copes with it. So we're more fortunate now that there's more services and things like that. But that's what I wanted the show to be about. The horizontal theme of mental health, this kind of struggle. And now that's grown into the concept of post-traumatic growth. What is that? What does it mean? Can I do that? Well, yeah, you can. Gonna probably have to work at it, but it's about being productive again and not allowing that to disable you because it doesn't necessarily need to do that. Is it difficult? Yeah. I mean, hell, listen to Cal Marvin talk. You know, nobody, after he was wounded, he crawled and staggered back to the battalion aid station. Nobody came and got him. And he said it took him a while. Yeah, that would leave a mark. Yeah, it would. So anyway, we're looking for a name of it. It's going to be like Turner Vet Leadership. Turner Veteran Leader Program. Lead at Turner. Maybe that's it. So that's what the program is, and really excited that we can be a part of that. And I hope it's the first of many initiatives that allow us to publicize companies that are looking for veterans. So, yeah, all you got to do is get in touch with myself or Bob Nielsen, and we'll point you in the right direction. So, next one is, hey, Mac, you alluded to some kind of graphic earlier in your open about the about North Korea missile range. Yeah, I did. If you go to, if you're on Facebook, and if you're not, you should get on Facebook, okay? And you should get on Twitter. Look, I didn't make up the rules. I'm just telling you about them. So, by all means, that's how the world communicates. That's how business gets done today on those kind of social media platforms. So you got to get out there. In fact, I was talking to somebody who was interested in advertising, and I told him, I said, hey, look, you either have to get out there or your organization's going to die. Okay. And, you know, and I will tell you, I have to give great compliments to, like the Marine Corps Combat Correspondents Association, who, I mean, those, they're older guys. There are a lot of World War II, Korea, Vietnam guys, and now they're interested. They don't want to see their organization go away. The Marine Corps Mustang Association, same way. A lot of older guys in it, but they love the organization. They see the good it does, and they want it to be perpetuated. But, and they've embraced, you know, social media. And so, you know, it's kind of interesting talking to them. And it's somewhat evidenced by General Neller in his comments in front of the Senate Armed Service Committee, where he says, I don't do social media. You know, a lot of guys say that with, like, it's some kind of, badge of honor. Look, the whole world is on social media. If you're not, guess what? Then you're not involved in the way your kids communicate, the people that work for you communicate. You're not involved. And I would tell you, you gotta at least have enough of a knowledge to be able to communicate with them and know how they function in their world. So again, it's a big deal. So yeah, anyway. If you go on Facebook right now, if you go to the All Marine Radio page and you scroll down, you'll see a number of posts. But the one you need to look for is one that says, how far can North Korean missiles reach? Interesting image on the reach of North Korean ICBMs from the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. And so if you take a look at that, what you'll see is there's Scud B, C, and ER, and you have a radius from North Korea, and then it shows the different missiles, okay, and the latest one, the NK-08, the NK-14 has a range of 6,200 miles, which across the United States, it's a diagonal line from Baja, California, so south of the California border. It looks like to Wisconsin, where the point of Wisconsin where the border heads south along the Great Lakes. I'm not sure if that's Lake Superior. I think it is. So if you draw a diagonal line from Baja, California through Superior, Wisconsin, where our border goes from east-west and then it kind of heads south right there, yeah, that corner of Wisconsin, then that's the range, that's the amount of the United States that is covered by the NK-14. Now, the NK-08, 7,200 miles, so an additional 1,000 miles, and what that allows them to do is reach all of the United States except the majority of Florida. The panhandle of Florida, yeah, you're inside of it. they can touch you. So, but it's a pretty cool little graphic that I threw up. I saw in the article, in fact, I threw a couple articles up on, one is, something Grant Newsham wrote, here in the last week. So I would recommend that to you. Grant Newsham, wrote, a very interesting piece about, if you haven't, you know, exhausted all measures, you certainly should. The title of it is, Before Attacking North Korea, Please Try Everything Else. Try Sanctions, Real Sanctions, by Grant Newsham. So he published this on April 12th, so last week. And then he said as much on the program. Also, I posted something that if you have not read it yet, I would tell you, I would tell you absolutely read it, because it's really it's fascinating reading, first of all, but it's something that gives you some sense of the kind of cyber warfare that nations are currently engaging in. And there's a reason that we don't say too much about it, I think. And I think the reason is we're doing more of it than anybody is. And the title of the book, it's written by David Sanger, who writes for the New York Times, a famous writer, and William J. Broad. I don't know Broad as well as I know Sanger. Anyway, Sanger's name is attached to some huge stories in our history. And there's a big picture of the leader of North Dakota, Kim Jong-un. But the essence of the story is this. Trump inherits a secret cyber war against North Korean missiles. And so it lays out the Korean missiles in kind of in detail. And it talks about the whys. It talks about the Obama administration. And so this cyber war that's being conducted against North Korea. So and what they would allege is the fact that that missile blew up on its launch pad yesterday, Saturday or Friday maybe. The fact that that happened was no accident. That is American cyber warfare. American cyber warfare in action. So there's a whole series of articles that have been written about the North Korean missile program in the New York Times. And so you can find the links, but I'll post them on the website. The next one that they wrote was the U.S. strategy to hobble North Korea was hidden in plain sight. That's how they got much of the information that they got for their work. The next one is called A Eureka Moment. This is by David Sanger. A Eureka Moment for Two Times Reporters. North Korea's missile launches were failing too often. So he talks about the articles and writing it. And I'll tell you, it's incredibly interesting stuff relative to this crazy regime that we're all kind of probably getting to know a lot more than we care to know about. So North Korea. But they're great articles. I would tell you, should be required reading to begin to understand, as Newsham's stuff is. You know, here's Newsham's problem, and here's China's problem. The spotlight will go from North Korea to China. Why doesn't China do something about this? You know, why does China want to see this? So, good question. So, we're going to take a quick break. Almarine Radio on a. I got some more emails to get to. Hey, Mac, where should we send emails to relative to the Turner construction stuff? You can send them to me here. Send them to me here. mac.allmarineradio@gmail.com. So send those things. And again, shotgun that thing everywhere. You have friends that you know, have you ever heard the term underemployed? He's got a job, but it's not a good one. That's underemployed. It you know, he or she is much more capable than the job they took. So go ahead and just shoot me an email and give me the name, and I can reach out to them. But again, help us find and change the lives of 50 people that can interview with Turner and start with them and change their life by helping them into a career that they do global construction. They do construction all over the country, all over the continent. So cool stuff. Anyway, more of All Marine Radio coming up here on a Monday on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good,
are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good, but are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life? The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit, into business development, and how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
On Veterans Day, the nation honors the men and women who risk their lives to protect our freedom. Social Security does its absolute best to honor veterans and active duty members of the military every day by giving them the respect they deserve. For those who return home with injuries, Social Security is a resource they can turn to. If you know any wounded veterans, please let them know about Social Security's Wounded Warriors website. The Wounded Warriors website answers many commonly asked questions and shares other useful information about disability benefits, including how veterans can receive expedited processing of disability claims. Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
On a Monday. Tomorrow's going to be a fun day. Don't miss it. Major General Paul Kennedy joins us. He was on, I want to say, probably about 3 weeks ago. And I've known General Kennedy since I was a captain. He's a first lieutenant. We worked together at the basic school as instructors and have been friends since. But he led 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, the Magnificent Bastards, if you will, in 2004. And we didn't shoot aviation ordnance in a city. They went out every day and got it on, Stalingrad style, trying to make peace, trying to figure out. You know, and it was so much different than the march up. It was 1,000 shades of gray in those communities. And so General Kennedy's going to join us. He also was the regimental commander in Sangin. And in that capacity, that's when 3-5 went through their stuff in Sangin. And so we'll talk to him about that whole deployment to Sangin and get his thoughts on kind of like the you know, I pull it out every once in a while, but a series that I call Things I'd Like My Sons to Know Before They Went to War. And I say sons, not daughters, because I have two sons in the Marine Corps, so I'm trying not to be a sexist. And so he'll join us tomorrow. And then he was out as, I want to say, deputy MEF commander, as a brigadier general, when I think it was earthquake, tsunami hit the Philippines, and went down there as a part of that. So I was working for one MEF and used to watch their what they were doing and if they needed anything for us and working in current ops and whatnot. So it was interesting to watch him. So, but he's a funny guy, but he's a smart guy. He's a really smart guy. And I, you know, like Dave Furness and the other guys that I brought on here that have talked about this stuff, it's very cool to be able to bring him on this kind of a forum and open up that knowledge to a lot of people. And so Paul Kennedy will join us. The other thing I'm trying to do is there's a number of efforts among females in the Marine Corps to create organizations that, you know, not in my Marine Corps, things like that, trying to enlist male Marines and putting an end to essentially what amounts to the bullying and harassment of women in the Marine Corps. Now, let me just tell you this. I would tell you that no matter what your feeling is relative to women in combat arms, you know, it's a completely different set of that to harass people. And I don't care what organization you're in. I have some oars in the water relative to bringing
you know, women, they're active duty women right now, on just to articulate what they're looking for and what they want to see. So, and I think for male Marines that are on active duty, it's time to stop messing with this stuff. Okay? The idiots among us need to be made to go away. So, and that's important. So I'm working on that story as well, working on having Grant Newsham come back on after the events in Korea over the weekend. And so we'll talk to Grant again this week. And then we'll talk about a little post-combat related mental health. So it's shaping up to be a great week on All Marine Radio, with certainly a lot of theaters to cover. So you have the fight with ISIS. You have in northwest Iraq, into Syria, and now Mosul. Although that fight continues. Eyes are shifting towards Tikrit and also to Raqqa. How are those things going to be done? You have, interestingly enough, you have the Defense Department that has just sent more advisors to Somalia. But you don't see any official comment by the Department of Defense, and much in keeping with what President Trump said he was going to do, which is, I don't feel the need to announce all these moves. We'll just make them. And our adversaries, they can dig for the information. So you're seeing that more and more. H.R. McMaster in Afghanistan. What do we need to do in Afghanistan to make that place better? So very interesting things, and so we will certainly endeavor to keep everybody up to snuff. Let's see, another email. Hey Mac, did you see the headlines about Turkey? It certainly isn't a good thing for NATO or the United States to have Turkey, which has been really a stabilizing force in the northern edge of that region, go the way it certainly seems to be going. And so I would recommend, I mean, do some reading on that. This move, in my opinion, this is the kind of move that sparks a coup in Turkey. And now the military has always kind of the military has always kept Turkey kind of in the direction of being a secular democratic nation. Okay. The problem is, you know, in retrospect, whatever that event that looked to me fairly choreographed, with all the great fanfare of the election, was that a staged event so that this could happen? Has he designed this? Is that far-fetched to think that would be staged? Or maybe a infiltrated cell could be used. So stage would be the wrong word. An infiltrated cell could be used as a pretext for something like this. Because they are going down the road of national, I don't want to say Nazi because that's too many. Historically, they're going down the road of national socialism. That kind of power in one man. Now, and here's why, here's, it was defeated, that referendum, if I pull the AP story up, as we get ready to exit stage right today. That referendum lost in Turkey's three major cities. Erdogan is now taking on his critics, saying, first, know your place. We won't see or hear politically motivated reports you prepare. So, and that's to the monitors of of the election. So it's moderately disturbing, and so it's very sad. Very sad what's happening in Turkey, and it's not going to stabilize the region. Not going to stabilize the region. So I don't know. You watch it and you shake your head. And in a day and age, why would Turkey grant those kind of powers to one guy? Overall, according to the state-run agency, 63.1% of Turks in Germany voted in favor of Erdogan's plans to greatly expand his presidential powers. Overall in Turkey, 51.4% of voters cast a yes ballot, and the no was at 48.6%. Some 1.4 million of the 3 million people of Turkish origin in Germany were eligible to vote. How about that? Pretty amazing. Anyway, I was just trying to see, relative to the results, what were the three cities? Ankara was one of them. President Francois Hollande says Turkish referendum results show a divided nation and is urging Turkish authorities to respect opposition voices and European values. She said in her statement that France takes note of accusations of substantial voting irregularities in Sunday's referendum, while the French leader said it's up to the Turks and them alone to decide their political organizations. She added that France will, quote, follow the greatest attention outside observers' evaluations, focus with great attention what outside observers' evaluations have said relative to a free and fair vote. So, anyway, that is a look at Turkey today. So, again, there's no shortage of news around the world that Al-Marine Radio focuses on, but interesting times that we live in. I want to thank Grant Newsham for his graciousness towards Al-Marine Radio. He's a great friend and comes on and is very cool. Next, relative to guest list, is the interview that we did with Cal Humphrey, which I would tell you is a little piece of American history. His attitude and his willingness to come on and share his thoughts. And in particular, he talks about, how he dealt with, post-combat related mental health issues. And that is the way, most guys of that era dealt with them. They came home and they stuck it in the closet, and they suffered in silence. Now, if you ask their wives about it, that would be a very different story. So, my thanks to Cal for coming on. He's a gem in the crown of all Marine radio. Don't forget, Major General Paul Kennedy tomorrow, hopefully for about 90 minutes. And so that'll be awesome. Again, he led a great group of Marines, Sergeant Major Jim Booker, who's now down in Texas. Major Dave Harrell, who you've heard on the program before. Dave Harrell's classic comment, "Mac, you could put a shotgun to my genitals and I don't think I could vote for Hillary Clinton, in spite of how crazy Donald Trump was." Anyway, that was awesome last October before the election. So J.D. Harrell was there. So, they're a good group of guys and they fought hard in Ramadi, so you get to hear about his thoughts on that. And certainly now that we're almost 15 years removed from that. So thank you for listening. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Subscribe to the podcast. Helps us sell ourselves and to continue to do what we do, which is a very cool project. So love doing it. Thank you very much for listening today. The program repeats itself in a matter of moments. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial.